This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome everyone to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. An exciting time in the field of medicine. That's why I guess if you're in the twilight of your career, you're somewhat pleased about that. But on the other hand, there are so many exciting things happening that, I'll probably miss most of that. And There's probably no area of medicine where there's more innovation, more exciting things going on than when it comes to the heart. And that's probably a good thing because, number one, it is still kills more Americans, men and women, than anything else. And number two, why not the heart? And
you got to have one that's working well.
Exactly. You know, they're repairing things through a catheter that used to require open heart surgery. They're replacing damaged parts, some of that also done through a catheter so they don't have to open the chest. And probably one of the most exciting areas is what's called regenerative medicine or cell-based therapy, the ability to get the heart, and not just the heart, but other organs in the body, to repair themselves. These organs, they inject these cells and the organs actually repair themselves. Pretty exciting.
Yeah. Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with two heart specialists who are leaders in the field of innovation, Dr. Rakesh Suri and Dr. Charles Bruce. That's exactly what we're going to cover today, replace, repair, and regenerate. That's our subtopic for today, or subtitle, I guess I should say. They have just come from a heart disease innovation summit that was here in Rochester, and they're going to tell us about the latest advances and what is in store for the future. Dr. Suri and Dr. Bruce, good morning. Welcome to the program. We're happy to have you here.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So I understand that, first of all, you've just come from this meeting, which was extremely well attended from physicians around the world. But I also understand that Rochester is actually a hotbed of innovation and patent generation, correct?
That's right, Tom. It was somewhat unsuspected, but perhaps not surprising when the Atlantic magazine in October 2013 ranked Rochester, Minnesota as one of the top three metros in the nation for per capita intellectual property and patent generation.
The top three in the nation here in Rochester.
That's right.
The others, one of them has to be out on the East Coast somewhere, the Boston area.
You know, things ebb and flow, but the current leaders are the Silicon Valley, Boulder, Colorado, and Rochester, Minnesota.
Wow.
And in Rochester, I suspect it all has to do with medical advances and innovations.
Yeah, you know, it's also the headquarters historically of IBM, as you know, or one of the sites that they've focused their innovations around. So in some part it has to do with IBM. But as part of the Destination Medical Center as well, there's really a new effort to focus all aspects of innovation around the Rochester hub. It's close to Chicago. It's close to stop-off points for the south and certainly for the west as well. So really exciting times in growing innovation in general in Rochester.
Oh, Dr. Bruce, you had said as we were getting ready, not only were heart doctors at this summit, but there was other people that were part of the event as well. Who else was there?
Yeah, Tracy. So this was an unusual summit. This summit was specifically designed to fuel innovation, to get it to our patients sooner.
Okay.
And funding is drying up. Traditional sources of funding are drying up. So the NIH funds are just difficult to get by.
Mm-hmm.
And getting VCs interested, particularly because of the
What is a VC?
A venture capitalist.
Okay.
And these are the sources of funding, but they want to see a return on the investment within 3 to 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And the problem with medical technology is it takes a longer time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's drying up too, particularly because of the obstacles of FDA regulations, mm-hmm. us having to do tests in devices overseas rather than the United States. So there are a number of hurdles that are preventing us as clinicians faced with the problems at the coalface with our patients,
mm-hmm.
and not being able to translate these really exciting opportunities in repair and replacement and regeneration and bring them to our practice right away. So the purpose of this meeting was to actually attract not only patients, but also the physician inventors, thought leaders in academia and industry, as well as the venture capitalists, as well as philanthropists, benefactors, thought leaders from industry, get them all together and actually talking about these problems and figuring out solutions of how we can actually bring these to our patients.
I have to think about the patients that were there being part of the room full of people that are talking about something that is going on inside your chest. Must be pretty impactful for some of those patients. How many patients were, do you know how many patients were at this event?
Well, interestingly, we are all patients, really.
Sure,
we are
right.
All beneficiaries of healthcare. So this was actually a by invitation only meeting. So there was just 100 people at this meeting. But again, stakeholders from all aspects to provide answers to these problems.
So your big issue right now is enough funding.
I think that's one of the challenges. So one of the challenges, if you imagine that you have an interest in investment, for example, and you happen to be interested in investing in healthcare, how do you know what the right thing is to invest in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the most important aspects is actually the needs. You know, one of the paradigms that, you know, we live by at Mayo Clinic is that the needs of the patient come first. So who better to actually identify the need than the physicians that work here?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need to translate those needs to people who are doing the invention. In fact, often that's people like Rakesh, myself, our colleagues, who are encountering these problems in our day-to-day practice. But what we need to do then is find the time and the resources, the engineering, and sometimes just the money to actually get these ideas into prototypes, test these prototypes, and then ultimately bring them to our patients.
Explain a little bit more about, I think I heard you say that you have to do studies outside the United States to learn about these techniques.
Yes, that is one of the big drawbacks about innovation in the United States, and that is putting the United States at risk for not being recognized and continuing their leadership role in medical innovation. In fact, Dr. Paul Yock, one of our keynote speakers, addressed this problem. And although per capita we are spending the most amount of money in healthcare, our outcomes are not necessarily as good as other countries where they're spending substantially less amount of money.
So and why is that?
Rakesh, do you want to maybe take that answer?
Thanks. I appreciate the handoff.
Well, mouth was getting dry. I could tell.
You know, there's a lot of reasons, and it comes down to the changing healthcare economy, the differing and evolving role of stakeholders, and as Charles pointed to, the problem with it leaping on the innovative pathway. So what do I mean by that? So as opposed to centers being solicited outside of the U.S. to sort of prove concepts or establish a patient population that are going to benefit from these therapies, what better place to start from than a place like Mayo Clinic, where there's a true breadth of patient population? You can really guide the therapies to the patients that need and understand the impact of that therapy. And that was one of the points of this conference, Tom. It was to really send a signal to industry that we at Mayo Clinic attract a whole host of patients who come to our institution for cutting-edge therapies. And if we're going to really test this next generation of therapies, let's do it at a place where we have clinical and scientific rigor so that we can not only deliver effective therapies, but also those that are cost-effective.
So are you saying we need to make it easier for patients to be part of these trials so that they don't have to be done in other countries?
Go ahead, Charles.
Well, actually, the reason is that the FDA puts stipulations in place that we need to prove that these studies are safe and effective.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Europe, the goal is that they're just safe.
Oh.
And the other issue is that it's just costly and expensive to do these early studies in the United States. It's less expensive to do it outside our borders. But I want to also just emphasize another aspect that came out of this meeting, and that is the importance of value-driven innovation. It's no good just simply coming up with a neat new tool. Again, this stems back to the needs. But not only do we need to say, is it necessary, but how much value can we bring? And so there's definitely a trend and a force now that it really is not a case of just developing a new neat tool, but that it actually has to provide value. So cost is entering the equation.
Yeah, terribly interesting with a lot of different moving parts. We need to take a short break. Coming up, we'll talk more with our two heart specialists, Dr. Charles Bruce and Dr. Rakesh Suri, and we'll talk about some of the innovations that they've already accomplished in the field of heart surgery. Plus, myth or matter of fact, stem cell therapy can be used to treat coronary artery disease and is an alternative to open heart surgery.
Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our specialists at 507-282-1234 or tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Charles Bruce, along with Dr. Rakesh Suri, and we are talking heart innovations and some of the things that they're able to do today they couldn't do a decade ago, and it's all extremely exciting, and some of these things are absolutely amazing. So let's start with you, Dr. Suri. What is it that you're able to do today or do differently than you could a decade ago?
Tom, that's a great question. As a surgeon, you sort of imagine us wielding scalpels and cutting things open all the time. Well, a decade ago, that was largely true. That said, the outcomes have always been very good at Mayo, and people have gotten on their feet quite quickly. But what's changed is this. We've taken those great gold standard operations that are associated with very good long-term outcomes and been able to miniaturize them. Do them, perform them inside of the chest and other body cavities without making large incisions. So really the ports or the access routes we're utilizing to get inside the chest now are about the size of your pinky finger. And one of those platforms is called robotics. Using forearms and a robotic telemanipulator, we're able to see inside of the chest and the working chambers and the valves of the human heart with 10 times magnification and high-definition visualization, kind of like watching the replay on a NFL football game on Sunday.
So you're at a computer screen watching what's going on, manipulating these instruments inside the chest.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what do we do with those arms? Well, we actually utilize micro sutures about the size of the diameter of a hair to actually sew the leaflets together.
So you're talking, when you say leaflets, you mean the heart valve. Well, how do you get these instruments in the chest?
Yeah. So there's a simple mechanism to gently guide the instruments between patient's ribs without cutting any large muscles or breaking any bones. And then we really sort of slip them past the vital structures, open the heart, and then get inside the heart itself.
This is where we need to go back now and say 15 years ago, Tom gave this term in my head, and I'll never be able to shake it, where you have to crack the patient's chest, which meant, you know, that it's a lot more invasive and a lot more recovery time for the patient. Yeah. That is no longer the case, correct?
Yeah, for the right patients, we direct them to the right therapies, and we don't tend to use the word crack. It tends to evoke
well,
a visceral
I'm a bone
response.
Doctor.
He's a bone doctor.
Yeah.
It's what he does.
I would think that sore is a better term.
You don't have to do that anymore, which is the great part.
Exactly. To your point, patients really do look a lot different when you don't have to cut any large muscles or surgically open any large bones. They have the breathing tube removed the night of surgery. They walk to their rooms on the floor out of the ICU the same night and are back on the street 3 days later. I even have contractors who have gone back to work 5 days after robotic surgery.
And how long, 10, 15 years ago, would that have been?
Well, you know,
is it a 2-week recovery back then versus a few days now?
Listen, we still have to tailor, as I said, the right operation to the right patient. So for many, many patients, an open chest approach is still the right operation. It's safest and most effective. Those patients typically stay about 4 to 6 days, and we ask them to not lift over 15 pounds for about 6 to 8 weeks. But with robotics, there's really no restrictions once they leave hospital.
And so, what are you talking about repairing here? What can you do inside the heart, and why did this happen, and who's a typical patient?
Right. So one of our main areas of interest in valvular heart disease at Mayo Clinic is mitral valve repair. Dr. Dwight Magoon, one of the founding fathers of cardiac surgery in the world, performed the first mitral valve repair here at Mayo in 1958.
All right. Now explain to us, if you wouldn't mind, what the mitral valve is.
Right. And the mitral valve is the valve that separates the lowest pressure chamber of the heart that takes blood from the lungs after being oxygenated and then directs it into the highest pressure chamber of the heart, which is the left ventricle. And the left ventricle is the last chamber after which the blood exits the heart and goes to all the organs of the body to sustain it with nourishing oxygen to the arms, to the head, to the legs, to the abdominal organs. So truly, if you can imagine that a dysfunctional mitral valve allows blood to flow backwards through the heart, back into the lungs, and causing dilatation or enlargement of the heart, and that leads to heart failure and death.
Oh, okay. So now who's the typical patient? Why would that valve go bad?
Well, great question. In a prior era, patients only came to us once they had symptoms. We know from long-term outcomes data performed at Olmsted County over the last 30 to 40 years that's not a good thing for patients. Patients who come earlier to surgical intervention do better long-term. How do they do better? They have less chance of dying and a lower chance of heart failure.
Okay, so what are those symptoms that they would present with?
So I'm going to hand that over to Charles. Charles is a clinical cardiologist, and truly the surgeons and cardiologists work on this important condition very, very closely. So Charles really tells us which patient should have surgery and at what times.
All right. Good teamwork. What are the symptoms that patients present with?
Well, it's interesting because there's a spectrum. So someone may actually not have any symptoms. They may simply just go for their annual physical. Their family practice doctor or internist or even cardiologist listen to their heart and they hear a murmur.
Whew, that's the best representation of a murmur I've ever heard.
I can give you a whole lot. But nevertheless, and this murmur or this heart sound that we're appreciating is this backflow of blood from the high pressure chamber into the low pressure chamber because of the leaky valve. In this case, the mitral valve, or sometimes it can be a valve that's blocked. And so you may not be aware of this, and in the case of the mitral valve, that may be the mitral valve looks like a parachute and has cords. And one of those cords can occasionally just break.
Sure.
So this is wear and tear, really, in a lot of cases.
Effectively. Yeah. Sometimes people are born with a predisposition or a tendency to develop some billowing or floppiness of that valve. And that can then result in this leakiness. And that over time can cause the heart to function inefficiently, get bigger, and ultimately not work properly. And Rakesh and colleagues at our institution have found that even in the absence of symptoms, if that leak is severe, and we determine that not by listening, but actually by doing echocardiography. It's a non-invasive tool. It's the same sort of technique that dolphins use and bats use for echolocation. Mm-hmm. Well, we do the same thing to look inside the chest, look at the heart, and look at the valve function and the blood flow. And we can actually quantitate, determine precisely how much blood is leaking. And when that is in the severe range, we can then advise someone who doesn't have any symptoms to undergo mitral valve repair. The other symptoms that characteristically are apparent with valve disease may be shortness of breath, lightheadedness, usually brought on by exertion.
So before those things show up, even if you are in for your physical, this is just a shout out to why you should be getting your physical, just
absolutely,
so that maybe
absolutely
you could hear that beautiful sound again. Now, that's how you would know.
Can you tell with your stethoscope which valve it is that's bad?
Yes, yeah, sure. And
really?
That's one of the traditions. Well, it's becoming a little bit of a lost art, but I grew up and trained in South Africa where we're not fortunate enough to have all the technology that is available at an institution like Mayo or here in the United States. So
you do have to be able to tell
the difference. What I do want to mention, though, is what is absolutely a modern-day miracle. We've been discussing mitral valve repair and robotic surgery, but that still requires, in most cases, stopping the heart, draining all the blood, so that the heart surgeon can actually see what he's doing. Because you can imagine trying to work and do these repairs, you've got blood in the way. So you need to get rid of that blood. So that means you need to stop the heart, protect the brain, put someone on a heart-lung machine.
Mm-hmm.
What's really remarkable about so innovative right now, that really is a modern-day miracle, is we can actually replace and repair problems with the heart on the beating heart. So actually, while there's blood still flowing. And again, we do that with the help of echocardiography.
Wow.
Unbelievable. So, Dr. Suri, myth or matter of fact, it's better to repair than replace.
Always better to repair if it can restore normal anatomy and physiology, Tom. And that's true everywhere from a knee to a hip to a human heart valve.
So if Dr. Bruce sees a patient who has a problem with her valve, then how do you determine whether or not it's appropriate to do it with the robot your way or whether it might require open heart surgery?
It's a tremendously important question, Tom. How do we match the right patient for the right therapy, whether it's open chest, transcatheter, or robotic? The answer is this. Patients will often call asking whether a candidate for one or the other, and we ask them to come and spend time with us to undergo testing, including echocardiograms and CT scans and angiograms to determine which they're a candidate for.
All right. You can always figure it out with the appropriate tests and consultations.
Repair, replace, regenerate. We even got to the regenerate part of this conversation yet.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You are listening to Mayo Clinic Radio with our guest, Dr. Rakesh Suri and Dr. Charles Bruce. Coming up this week's health and medical news with Vivian Williams. Plus, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234 or tweet us your question at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Researchers from Stanford University School of Medicine found a new way to predict which patients with age-related macular degeneration may suffer from the most debilitating form of the disease, meaning if left untreated, they'd likely go blind. They can also tell when it might happen. It's all based on crunching all the data that eye doctors already get during exams. The new way of looking at the info with computerized imaging can help make smarter decisions about treatment. It helps them figure out who's at risk. Now, age-related macular degeneration is the leading cause of blindness and central vision loss among adults older than 65. And this study was published in the Journal of Investigative Ophthalmology and Visual Science. And now on to news about the brain. Mayo Clinic got two large grants for projects on frontotemporal dementia, or FTD, which is characterized by degeneration of the frontal and temporal lobes of the brain. It's rare, but it can strike people in their 20s and even their teens. The projects also include ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and they're aimed at improving the diagnosis and treatment of patients suffering from both of these disorders. Now, both conditions are most commonly caused by the same gene, and they want to find targeted therapies to help treat the conditions. Here's Dr. Kevin Boylan.
It's believed that this type of approach, looking at an individualized type of therapy, may turn out to be the future of this disorder because it's believed increasingly that people with ALS don't all have the same condition in the same sense that people with some forms of cancer have distinct forms of cancer. And that this type of individualized targeted therapy is really going to get us much closer to effective treatment.
And now news from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. A study from researchers there looked at a sort of battle of the sexes. They checked out who has a better sense of smell. It turns out men and women differ a lot in how they perceive odors, and women did better on many smell tests in the study. They say differences in how the sexes smell may play a role in social behavior. So how did they figure out about women's smelling superiority? Well, there have been brain imaging studies to see what happens when you smell, but these researchers measured the number of cells in the brain that have to do with smelling. The researchers from the Federal University of Rio and the Ministry of Science and Technology in Brazil found biological evidence in the brains of men and women that may explain the difference between genders. They say it makes sense that because women have more smelling-related cells in their brains, that they can smell things better. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and today's guests, both heart specialists, Dr. Rakesh Suri and Dr. Charles Bruce. We are on air, online, and on iHeartRadio. By the way, you can listen live. Go to KROCAM.com. Push. Listen live. Time for you to join our conversation, 507-282-1234. Any question you'd like to, almost any question you'd like to ask about heart disease, these two gentlemen are both specialists. And by the way, I have in my Mayo Clinic radio library two copies of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life book, and I'd like to give those to a couple of our listeners. 507-282-1234, our first two callers.
Just call us with a question.
Yeah, and how about tweets?
Yep, you can send us your tweets, too, at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. And we'll take those at any time. So we did have the myth or matter of fact that we talked about, and our subheading for today's show was repair, replace, and regenerate. So we need to just brush up against that third R. We do not have the regeneration expert here, but explain to us what regenerate is, Dr. Bruce.
So regeneration is sort of the holy grail, mm-hmm. because like we mentioned, you know, even a moderately or slightly dysfunctional valve is actually better than a replaced valve, mm-hmm. which is an unusual sort of fact. And if we can repair a valve, that's the first thing we'd want to do. But sometimes that valve is not repairable, and therefore it has to be replaced. And then a person then needs to take blood thinners if it's a mechanical valve, or if it's a tissue valve not made out of metal, then that sometimes allows patients to avoid having to take blood thinners. But unfortunately, those valves don't tend to last as long.
Sure.
So if we can avoid putting a valve in and we don't have to repair something, how about actually regenerating it?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some exciting work that uses cell-based therapy. We'd prefer to use that term rather than stem cells.
Sure.
Because, in fact, these cells can be harvested, or we obtain them from the patient themselves.
Right.
And then when we put them in a test tube with just the right sort of growth factors and hormones and things, those actually tickle the cell to actually make them into a cell that can become any kind of cell. And obviously, as a cardiologist, we want to tickle those cells and make them into a heart cell.
So our myth or matter of fact was that there was that stem cell therapy, or what is the phrase you wanted to use instead of stem cell therapy?
Cell-based therapy
can be used to treat coronary artery disease and is an alternative to open heart bypass surgery. So is that a myth, or is that a fact, or will that be a fact?
It's a myth. And of course, we all hope that one day it will be a fact. But right now, a lot of research still needs to go into bringing this into clinical practice.
Very good.
So we've mentioned open heart surgery, sort of passe anymore. And we've talked about robotic surgery, but I heard you mention catheters, and I want to hear more about that after we take a couple of phone calls.
We do. Steve and Joe both have some questions. They both want your book copy. So guys, make sure that you stay on the phone. Steve has a question about rheumatic fever. Steve, go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, when I was a child, I had rheumatic fever, and I was fortunate to not have heart damage afterwards, but I was often asked if I had heart damage. And I was wondering, what is it that rheumatic fever can do to the heart?
Great question. Yeah. Dr. Bruce, go right ahead.
Thanks for calling, Steve.
Hold on the line, Steve.
This is a very good question. And in fact, rheumatic fever is something that we seldom see now in the United States and in first world countries. In developing countries, and in fact, in South Africa, where I did my training, rheumatic fever is still a big problem. Fortunately, in your case, you don't have any heart muscle damage, but The rheumatic fever is caused by a bacteria that can cause an inflammatory or an inflammation reaction that can affect all aspects of the heart, but most commonly the heart valves. So fortunately, in your case, if your valves were spared, it's unlikely that you're going to have any problems.
And you don't develop that later on in life? It would happen right away?
No, it doesn't. In fact, so the problem is that you have the infection and it only develops over many years. But judging by Stephen, he sounds like a somewhat...
He was lucky.
He was a lucky guy. But nevertheless, it certainly would be worthwhile that he has regular checkups, certainly has an annual examination, and an echocardiogram, that non-invasive ultrasound test that I was referring to.
So this is something that could really not show up until middle age or later.
Absolutely.
Very good.
Dr. Suri, have you repaired some patients who had rheumatic fever and damage to their valves as a result?
The answer is yes, Tom. When rheumatic disease is at its end stage, meaning it's gone on for 10, 20 years, it sometimes becomes calcified, and then we have to cut out the valve and replace it. But if when patients present earlier, and particularly in their teens or 20s, we're sometimes able to repair these valves.
Wow. Incredible. Right, with Steve, the robot.
Yeah, Steve, yeah. Thank you for calling in. Hold on the line. Audrey, our producer, will get your address and send you a book.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Joe in Stuartville. Joe has got a question. He wants to know about newborn heart issues. Go right ahead, Joe.
Good morning. Most of the discussion this morning has consisted of adults, young adults. And I'm just wondering about the newborn and the unborn. Are there any advances in that area as far as treatment of heart defects that are discovered?
Okay,
yeah.
Dr. Suri.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, so there's a whole specialty of cardiologists and cardiac surgeons and interventional cardiologists who focus on the newborn and diseases, heart diseases of children. And in fact, as those children successfully survive their operations and interventions, they grow up to be adults, and that's a specialty called congenital heart disease. Mm. We have interests and expertise in these at Mayo Clinic Rochester, and we do treat these routinely.
Very good.
In fact, on a personal note, our daughter was born with a heart defect. She had congenital heart disease, and she underwent surgery here at Mayo Clinic. And you know, she's a friend of your daughter's, Tom.
Yeah,
and
she's a wonderful young woman.
You would
by
never
the way.
Say so. She's no. a rambunctious young woman.
I mean, you went through several operations, or didn't
no, just,
you?
Just the one.
But it was a big deal. It was a serious problem.
When you think about doing an operation, and this really is testimony to the advances in cardiac surgery. When she had her surgery, she was just a few months old. Her heart was the size of an acorn. Can you imagine doing this kind of surgery on a little acorn? It's truly a miracle of modern medicine.
And that repair has lasted, obviously, forever.
Tremendously. Now, of course, it's important for those of you out there who do have congenital heart disease and who have, remember that we'd like to say that although you can expect a really long life, you're never really cured. It is very important that you have regular checkups with a cardiologist, and particularly a cardiologist who has expertise in congenital heart disease.
Well, whatever they did to fix Olivia's heart, they did a great job because she's as active as anybody I've ever known.
All right, Jill, thanks for your question. Audrey will take your address, and we'll get that book to you. At the beginning of the program, you know, we were talking about this is all because of a heart summit that was just held here in Rochester this past week. And it brought together not just physicians. There was you had a patient that was part of it that was one of your speakers, but also people that you want to get excited about, you know, venture capitalists and philanthropists. Let's talk about that a little bit more, as unfortunately we're starting to run out of time. But why are we heading in that direction now? You said there's not as much funding through the NIH. Did you feel like now on the backside of the summit that it was successful, that you did find people that were excited about this? Dr.
Was there anybody in the audience with a big wallet?
I was trying to be a little more demure than that, but yes.
I would hope so, but I'm hoping that you know, for those of you out there who really do have an interest in helping patients, helping us help our patients, we need your help. We need the kind of funding to fuel and accelerate the kinds of inventions that medical innovators are thinking up, so that we can help our patients not tomorrow. We need to help them today. And so that really was the purpose of this meeting. And I think by all measures, it's going to be successful because we've got the networking, we've got the discussion going. Time will tell.
You know, you mentioned before our break at the bottom of the hour about the catheter treatment. We heard about the robotic surgery from Dr. Suri. Tell us a little bit more about what you can do through the catheter and what a catheter is.
Tom, thanks for asking this, because this truly is another modern day miracle. If you had asked me when I was a medical student, and that's sort of some time back, but not too far back,
no,
in the 1980s.
Not at all.
Okay, in the 1980s. And I was in South Africa. And if you'd said to me, Charles, we can replace a heart valve without opening up the chest and without stopping the blood flow, I would have said that's science fiction.
Even in the 80s?
In the
80s. That doesn't seem that long ago.
I would have said that is science fiction.
Hmm.
But truly, we are doing that on a routine basis today. And what's really remarkable is that this kind of procedure is allowing us to treat people who would otherwise be too sick to be put onto a heart-lung machine or to go through that standard operation. And so it really has opened up an avenue of really remarkable therapies. And not only are we able to now replace these valves, there's a thing called the transcatheter And a catheter, just by the way, it's a
yeah,
fine,
tell us exactly how you
it's
do
a
this.
Tube.
What happens?
It's a fine tube, so it looks like a straw, but much thinner. And you can you make a little hole in the artery in the leg, and that artery obviously is connected to the heart. And you thread the straw all the way up the artery or in the vein, get it inside the heart, and then can actually thread the valve or the repair device or the clip sometimes through that straw and attach it to the valve or replace the valve instead of the dysfunctional.
So
valve.
You're snaking it up there. How many times is it? Do you miss? Sometimes miss or did can
never?
Well, remember, I don't want to take credit for actually doing the procedure because I'm actually the imaging guy. I'm the eyes. I'm the eyes to the procedure. So my role is to actually do a transesophageal echocardiogram. It's a probe that we stick down the back of the throat in the throat pipe. And because the throat pipe or the esophagus lies very close to the back of the heart, we get beautiful views of the heart.
Hmm.
And then there's new technology now that allows us to see the heart in three dimensions. So we can slice and dice the heart in three dimensions while our interventional colleagues who are holding the straw catheter actually deliver the tool. So they're delivering it in the right place at the right time.
And then what can you do to the valve? I mean, can you sew it? Can you remove part of it?
No, the valve...
What do you do?
The valve is in a stent, which is sort of like a metal coil. And you probably are familiar with stents that we use to open up blocked heart arteries for people who have had heart attacks and things like that. Well, now these stents are just a little bit bigger. They're a wire coil that is squished. And inside that squished coil is the valve. And then when they get it in across the diseased valve, the valve that's not working properly, with a balloon, we can open up that coil, and that then stretches out the valve and puts it in place of the diseased one.
So you're replacing the valve, basically.
Exactly.
So maybe I can just jump in here, Tom. So the novel aspect of these therapies are truly partnerships between surgeons and cardiologists. So I do these every day with my interventional cardiology colleagues, and as Charles pointed to, he really helps with the clinical diagnosis and imaging. But to your answer, yeah, we fix some of these valves, the mitral and next the tricuspid, and replace others, including the aortic and the mitral valve. What's new, and there are people at Mayo who are doing this first in the world, is that when an old valve goes bad that's been sewn in, we can actually replace it with the new valve inside of it. So in actuality, it's called a valve-in-valve procedure. So really, these are all new. They're being propagated at Mayo Clinic, and there's truly partnerships that haven't existed in the past between interventional cardiology and surgery.
So how do you decide between the two of you, or the three of you, the surgeon who used to open the chest with a saw? How do you decide who should be doing the procedure on a particular patient?
This is a very good question, because this really represents now modern-day therapy for patients with structural heart disease or valvular heart disease, and particularly why an institution like Mayo is so good at it. Because what you really do need to do is you need to get all these experts together. And each person is treated differently. It's very individualized, because one person may have a whole lot of other medical problems that preclude them from undergoing a standard operation. And so therefore, maybe a transcatheter-based approach would be more appropriate. So it really is a combined, what we call a heart team approach. And that's in fact why Rakesh and I are such good colleagues, because we're interacting so much. Images, surgeons, the interventional cardiologists, as well as our radiologists, all getting together to make these decisions.
Well, teamwork is really one of the reasons that the Mayo Clinic is so good, is as good as it is. There's no question about that. And it's true in every field. So, Dr. Suri, you've told us that about some of the things that you can do that you weren't able to do a decade ago. What is it that you would like to be able to do in the future that you can't do right now? What are you working on?
Well, what's interesting is, as Charles alluded to, our specialties are really overlapping. So the traditional boundaries or barriers between surgeons and cardiologists is really blurring. We're becoming truly heart specialists. So what we want to do next is truly to effect more durable, create more durable procedures that will treat people at an earlier stage and prevent costly diseases from happening, like heart failure, angina, which is chest pain, and requiring emergency surgery. So we want to get to patients earlier. The second thing is we want to partner with industry, and that was the point of our meeting. We have such a great depth of clinical expertise and fantastic partnerships. We want to, with those ideas and that clinical expertise, partner with industry and drive the new clinical trials that are going to design and prove these new devices here at Mayo Rochester. From that, we hope we'll be able to foster innovation, create new devices, and help people earlier in order to help our healthcare system.
Dr. Bruce, what is it that you'd like to be able to do that you can't do today, and what are you working on?
I'd like to be able to bring these very exciting innovations to our patients as soon as possible. And I'd like to have as much help from all these various sources come together and get it done. And that goes from funding to regulation, and may even need some help from the community in lobbying our government to look at how we can improve the funding and decrease the regulatory burden.
People that are excited about that and interested in what we've just been talking about, how can they take the next step and do that? Do you want them to call you, or they call the Mayo Clinic? What would you like them to do, Dr. Suri?
Well, our valvular heart disease clinic that Charles, actually one of the supervisors for and organizing us all, is really the intake to this paradigm we've been speaking about today. We are hoping through these efforts that we'll drive new clinical trials, and there's always new things on the horizon. So I would say that anybody with heart disease, call us. We'll talk to you, we'll explain things, and we'll tell you what's available.
You know, you guys are both fabulous, and the things that you're doing, absolutely incredible. It sort of makes you feel like if you get heart disease later on in life, these guys can fix you.
Oh, it's good to know these guys. That's right. I got their email addresses.
Yeah, I like to say that we mend broken hearts.
Yeah. Hey, nice. I want to hear that murmur one more time before we go. Perfect. Dr. Charles Bruce, Dr. Rakesh Suri, thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you very much.
Really a pleasure.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll talk about next week's program. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. By the way, if you did not receive a complimentary copy of the book Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life, there's still another way you can get it.
That's
this
right.
As well as other Mayo Clinic periodicals and books.
Books and DVDs can be purchased at the Mayo Clinic store here in Rochester at the subway level of the Siebens building, or go to mayoclinic.org for the bookstore.
All right. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with lung specialist Dr. David Midthune.
You know that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. And
didn't
it's also
that.
The Great Smokeout is always the middle of November. That date will be coming up. But there's a great way to discover if people will have lung cancer, whether you're a smoker or not. And it has to do with CT imaging, with a CAT scan.
Yeah, it's true that smoking is still the leading cause of lung cancer in this country. But we also know that it's extremely important to catch lung cancer early. And there have been lots of studies which have, I think, come to the conclusion, there's a little bit of controversy, that CT is the best way to detect it. But I think the question is, who ought to have a CT and how often? And we'll find out next week with Dr. David Midthune.
That's right. We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, that's mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program as well as previous episodes. And that's not all. At mayoclinic.org, over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, news director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Rakesh Suri and Dr. Charles Bruce, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.